integrates bureaucrats. Second set of changes. Third set of changes were political. Pretty straightforward. Peter the Great was obviously interested in some of the new specialization and training institutions associated with absolute monarchy in Western and Central Europe. He developed somewhat more specialized bureaucratic services. He created a state council to oversee bureaucratic activities. These were, I don't mean they're trivial, but these were pretty obvious things for an aspiring authoritarian ruler to import to make his rule more clear-cut. And finally, Peter the Great instituted significant, though not uniform, military and economic changes. He established a Russian navy, importing Western artisans and advisors to do so. He tried to improve the armament of the Russian army, as well as reorganizing it into somewhat clearer-cut categories of command, again along partially Western lines. He also was eager to organize the Russian metallurgical industry, taking advantage of Russia's terrific holdings in iron ore, so that Russia would have the economic basis for independent weapons productions, so that Russia would be able to maintain a significant level of military armament at a reasonably high technical level without having to rely on an ongoing basis on Western imports. These changes added up to a desire to enhance the power of the Tsar by insisting not only on new bureaucratic reforms to make the state more efficient, but even by insisting on the Tsar's right to cut off the beard of a nobleman. What better way symbolically to make it very clear that the nobles were subordinate to the rule of the Tsar than to argue the Tsar could determine what they were supposed to look like? So, goal number one, enhance the power of the Tsar and the state in what was still a fairly ineffective state apparatus. Goal number two, quite clear, enhance the power of the Russian military so that it could indeed play a role in European affairs and so it would have an increasing edge in its military conflicts elsewhere, particularly with the Ottoman Empire. Probably the most concrete result of Russia's westernization at this point was indeed to make this gunpowder empire increasingly effective, one of the reasons that it would prove so durable. Goal number three, really intriguing because it's something that happened at this point in Russia and would happen in other places later on. Goal number three was to deal with what one might call an embarrassment factor with Russia vis-a-vis the West. Peter the Great obviously assumed that interchange between Russia and the West would become increasingly frequent. He needed Western advisors. He was encouraging Western intellectual imports. But in the process, it became very clear that without some additional changes, Russia was going to be looked at by the Westerners as barbaric and backward. How to deal with this? Well, make at least upper-class Russia look increasingly Western. One of the interesting specific changes that Peter the Great introduced, for example, was the elimination of a Russian tradition whereby when a young woman got married, her father would hand a whip to the groom, a symbol of the transfer of male authority over women. This blow for greater female independence certainly pleased upper-class women in Russia, but it also was another way in which Peter was trying to make at least the appearances of upper-class society more palatable in Western eyes. Equally important, however, was what Peter the Great did not westernize. He obviously did not import increasingly current Western ideas about constitutional monarchy, the importance of parliament, the importance of division of powers. This was of no interest. It wasn't yet dominant in the West itself, in fairness, but he could have picked it up in Holland, undoubtedly was aware of it, no interest in it. It contradicted the purposes that he had in mind. He was not interested either in any significant reforms that affected ordinary Russians. He did not ameliorate the conditions of the serfs. He did not try to make Russia an increasingly wage labor economy. He did not try to bring cultural change to ordinary Russians. He did not change the educational apparatus, which was frankly minimal, of ordinary Russians. He did not challenge the hold of Orthodox Christianity on ordinary Russians because he had no interest in doing so. This would have undermined his authority, roused resistances that he had no interest in encountering. Perhaps most revealing of all, he clearly did not did not want to make Russia a commercial kind of economy along the Western model. He wanted economic change. He wanted a production basis for successful and independent military activity. But he did not particularly encourage the merchant class. He was content to rely heavily on Western enclaves of merchants in Moscow and in his new city of St. Petersburg to organize the bulk of Russia's trade with the West. Landlords, among other things, would have resisted, did resist, any move to enhance merchant power because they would see this as a threat to their own social and political superiority. Peter's goal, in fact, if we could go back to the terms of the world economy, Peter's goal, although he didn't know the term, was actually to maintain Russia as an external economy, capable of producing what it needed for its own economic operation and for its expanding military activity without depending on other areas, but not seeking commercial dominance over other areas outside of Russia itself, not seeking a core status in any real way at all. These developments, in other words, created significant change in Russia. The Westernization was quite real, but also, in an ironic way, enhanced Russia's differences with the West at the same time. This was a Russia that did join Western cultural life, not yet as a major producer, but within a century it would be producing literature, music, and some art that entered the general European orbit. Peter the Great was obviously eager to enhance Russia's role as a European diplomatic and military player, and this too would expand over time. But again, he was not interested. He was deliberately uninterested in creating a Western society. That would not have suited his purposes, which were quite selective. And in confirming, indeed enhancing the gap, for example, between ordinary Russians and the new Russian upper classes, Peter the Great created circumstances that were quite different from those of the West and would have different outcomes later on. Most obviously, by encouraging upper-class Russians to be increasingly Western in their ways. By the middle of the 18th century, some Russian noblemen did not speak Russian at all. They only spoke French. By increasing their Westernization while confirming the inferiority and servitude of ordinary Russians, Peter created a social gap that was quite different from that which existed in much of Western Europe. There were social tensions there as well, but they didn't involve this depth of cultural divide. A different product was being created. Finally, Peter the Great's changes had at least two unintended consequences that from this point onward would also help inform Russian affairs and, on the whole, continue to differentiate Russia from the West per se, while connecting it to the West without any question. First, although Peter's reforms did not produce a huge outcry during his own reign, his power was too great to permit this. After his death and the arrival of weaker successors, a number of voices were raised against what Peter had done, coming particularly from the Orthodox clergy that were quite worried about the implications of Westernization, but coming from some landlords and others as well. The result in Russia as a whole, and sometimes in the individual Russian leaders themselves, the result was a real ongoing ambivalence as to what Russia's relationship with the West should be. Should Russia become more Western than Peter intended? Some of the noblemen who now visited the West would argue, yes, the West was the model, and Russia's mistake was simply not going far enough. Or should Russia actually pull back because core Russian values were actually superior to those of the West, and Peter the Great's flirtation was in fact a great danger? The ambiguity with regard to the Western relationship was something that would crop up recurrently in Russian history from this point onward. Early in the 19th century, during the Soviet era, and I think arguably at the turn of the 21st century as well, it becomes a durable or at least recurrent feature of the Russian cultural character. The second unintended consequence was also fascinating. While Peter, again if I could be permitted to use the world economic terms, while Peter intended Russia to remain external, what he did encouraged actually some further involvement with Russia in the European-dominated economy on terms that were not terribly favorable to Russia itself. Most obviously, despite Peter the Great's interest in seeing the Russian economy remain independent of the West, more and more upper-class Russians thirsted for Western goods. They wanted increasing numbers of Western paintings of the sort that would ultimately accumulate in one of the great collections of Western art anywhere in the world in St. Petersburg. They wanted growing amounts of Western furniture. They wanted Western lecturers. They wanted Western access in various sorts. It became a standard feature of the life of a young nobleman to have a grand tour in the West that could last many months, even years. These appetites for Western-type goods cost money. And along with the continued need to import certain kinds of equipment from the West, created a new balance of payments situation in which Russia was pressed increasingly to augment its export patterns to the West by emphasizing timber products, minerals, and particularly grains. Russia became, by the later 18th century and on into the 19th century, one of the great grain suppliers for Western markets, depending on servile labor, depending on increasingly harsh servile labor, in fact, as punishments and restrictions over the peasantry steadily expanded. This smacked increasingly, if not of a peripheral economy, at least of an economy that was somewhat peripheral, not as different, say, from Latin America as Peter the Great and other Russian leaders might have aspired to. This, then, was an important set of moves. It probably did help maintain the strength, particularly the military strength, of the Russian imperial experiment. And again, of all the great gunpowder empires created in the early modern period, Russia has had the most lasting success in maintaining at least much of its expanded territories intact. But these developments also set other new currents in motion in Russia that would have further effects on Russia's relationship with the wider world, sometimes creating new links, particularly with the West, but sometimes creating new tensions, as Russians might spring back against too much Western linkage, a process that, again, would be set in motion and would crop up from time to time on into the present day.
Lecture 23, Asian Empires and a Shogunate.
Our focus in this discussion is on Asian societies during the early modern period. Frankly, it's a presumptuous combination. This is a huge territory with all sorts of different societies that experienced all sorts of different developments during this long period. But a few generalizations are possible, and they will help round out our understanding of what was going on during these interesting centuries. One of the first things to emphasize is the extent to which attention, even brief, to Asian developments in the early modern period needs to fight longstanding prejudices and stereotypes. Many of my students, who sometimes don't seem to know a lot about world history when they come into my class, nevertheless do know that China was isolated, China was conservative, and this set of characteristics seems to dominate some impressions of China, at least before recent times. This was a period in which most Asian societies were actively engaged in wider connections in the world on different terms from those that operated in Western Europe, to be sure, but actively engaged. This was not, in the main, an isolationist period. This was not a period of economic retrenchment. And the necessity of confronting some of these misimpressions head on is one of the crucial reasons to deal with this wide-ranging topic in a specific session. We'll return at the end to the question of why it's so important to rectify the record, and many world historians have actively contributed to this task. There were two big developments, again, trying to look at the big picture with regard to a number of different societies. Two big developments in Asian societies during the early modern period. The first, which we already touched on in dealing with the absolute necessity of modifying the world economy approach where Asia is concerned, the first development was increasing prosperity, at least for some groups, as a result of Asia's participation in producing for world markets and receiving goods, including American silver, in exchange. As we noted, a number of Asian societies were significantly altered by this growing commercialization. Merchants gained new roles. Money use gained new roles. Governments gained access to additional resources themselves. So this participation in global patterns, yielding, again, at least selective prosperity, was a significant development in its own right, confirming, among other things, an interest in export-based manufacture in parts of China, an interest in transmission to world markets in parts of India, etc. The second development, which we've also mentioned but not fully fleshed out, was the emergence of a series of gunpowder empires in much of the Asian landmass. We will also be dealing today with a somewhat separate set of developments in Japan, which don't quite fit the gunpowder empire model. But the emergence of a number of quite solid empires operating over a considerable period of time is a really interesting set of parallelisms in Asian history during this period. The new empires were three in number, in addition, of course, to Russia, which itself established a significant Asian presence during this period. The new empires were three in number. First came the Ottomans. The Ottoman Empire began to take shape in the middle of the 15th century. It's one of the factors that helped launch the early modern period. It extended its hold over much of southeastern Europe, including at the high point, even Hungary. It developed significant holdings in much of the Middle East, though not all of it. It extended its direct control to Egypt and had some nominal control over other parts of North Africa, though not Morocco. This was a major and, in fact, long-lasting empire. It outlived the Roman Empire, among other things, if you just count years. The second empire to emerge, also extremely important, this one developing in the early 16th century, was the Mughal Empire in India. The Mughal Empire was formed as a result of invasions from a force that operated through Afghanistan. Early Mughal emperors were extremely interested in establishing a solidly based imperial structure in India. They were frequently extremely intelligent. They were interested in new ideas. They were eager to combine traditional Indian practices with new elements. They were explicitly extremely tolerant in religion. They utilized Hindus as well as Muslims in administration. This was a rich period in Indian history under Mughal control. Here, too, the empire expanded considerably territorially. It never controlled the entire Indian subcontinent, but it did command an increasing chunk in north and central India and even attempted to some extent to reach south. The third great gunpowder empire, though a smaller one, was the Safavid Empire in Persia, which helped revive a sense of Persian identity and presence. Still Muslim, there was no overall cultural change here. This empire had a significant existence for a couple of centuries. China, of course, operated according to a somewhat different rhythm because here the imperial tradition was well established. And much of the early modern period saw the operation of the Ming Dynasty, established a bit before the early modern period. But as we've noted briefly before, the second dynasty of the early modern period, and in fact what turned out to be China's last dynasty, had a few elements of gunpowder empire attached to it as well. This final dynasty, the Qing, formerly known as the Manchu, was organized by Manchurians coming in from northern China, and while they adopted Chinese institutional patterns and culture in many ways, they remained partially outsiders in their own estimation and in that of the Chinese. So there was in China as well an element that was not dissimilar to the other gunpowder empires, involving an intrusion from outside, helping to shape the imperial experience more generally. These empires had significant accomplishments. It is obviously valid to note, as for example Chinese observers have in looking back at this period, it is obviously valid to note that the developments that occurred under the gunpowder and Chinese empires were not overall quite as dynamic as those occurring in Western Europe. Asian power began relatively to decline a little bit if measured against European power. For example, by 1700, European technologies in metallurgy and in some branches of textile production were now probably superior to their Asian counterparts. Not yet massively superior, but a balance that had been so long standing in world history, in which technological leadership and innovation centered in Asia, particularly East Asia, and tended to move westward. This balance during the early modern period was beginning to shift toward greater Western parity and even slight leadership, a shift that would obviously be compounded in the later 18th and 19th centuries. So in talking about the achievements of the gunpowder empires, the developments in Asia in this period, both economic and political, it is important to note, at risk of encouraging stereotype, which is not my goal, it is important to note that there was a certain shift in balance, and Asian developments in terms of sheer power politics and economic dynamism were not quite keeping pace with some of the leading patterns in Europe. Still, the gunpowder empires had significant achievements to their credit. Some textbook approaches mention the gunpowder empires and then race to their decline, and we'll have to talk about their decline, at least in part, as a late early modern phenomenon as well. But the achievements need to be noted in addition. The Ottoman Empire brought a number of developments to the Middle East and Southeastern Europe. They obviously helped solidify and highlight a new Turkish presence in the northern Middle East, the fruit of migration as well as political control. But it was equally important to note that Ottoman administration was never purely Turkish. It admixed a number of other peoples, including non-Muslims, in a tradition that actually had been well established in earlier periods in the Middle East. The Ottoman Empire helped encourage the spread of Islamic belief to a significant minority of people in parts of southeastern Europe. Christian groups were tolerated for the most part, though there were some forced conversions of a group of young military people seized as part of the Ottoman military force, the Janissaries. But the changes in the religious map in southeastern Europe were noteworthy, as well as some new antagonisms that seemed to spring up around Ottoman control. Ottoman relationships with Arabs also deserve attention. While the Ottoman Empire used individual Arabs as well as Christians and Jews in administration, on the whole, the Ottoman Empire confirmed a somewhat dependent and inferior political status for Arabs, whom many Turks looked down on to some extent, and that pattern has to be factored in to developments in the Middle East, even to contemporary times as well. The Ottoman Empire introduced significant cultural changes into the Middle East. A form of mosque developed, best illustrated by some of the great mosques of Istanbul and its environs, that blended actually Byzantine architectural forms with Muslim needs, an interesting innovation. Ottoman contributions to literature and art, often in Arabic, were also significant. Political, some religious, and cultural achievements then left a lasting mark on the Middle East, even as the Ottoman hold would begin to decline. Mughal contributions to India, again, numerous. At its high point, a system of considerable tolerance and intermixture of Hindus and Muslims was a contribution, though unfortunately not an entirely lasting one. Mughal cultural contributions were really major. The Mughals helped further Persian artistic influence in India, leading to new forms of portraiture. The Mughals were also interested in receiving some Western cultural influences, not deep ones, but influences that affected a style of portrait painting and even dress in the upper classes in Mughal India. Much of what we rate as Indian cuisine today dates from the Mughal period. In other words, the Mughals introduced significant cultural richness into the Indian tradition, as well as, of course, important individual symbols like the great Taj Mahal. The Mughals also, arguably, furthered a sense not of Indian unity, but of the possibility of creating larger territorial units in the Indian subcontinent, which, of course, the British would pick up and then which would feed directly into considerable Indian unity after the British rule passed. This was a contribution worth noting. And the Mughals also developed administrative and taxation structures that would have long impact in India, again, even after the Mughals themselves departed. Mughals were even interested, although this one didn't take, in reforming certain other traditional Indian practices, for example, the practice of sati, which they disapproved of but didn't ultimately have quite the clout to attack directly. Developments in Safavid Persia, again, included a revival of a sense of Persian identity. It was under the Safavid Empire that Farsi was established as the dominant language of the region, as it still is today in Iran. Again, cultural developments that go beyond the mere fact of stating the existence of an empire. And developments in Qing China included, again, significant participation in economic prosperity, the re-elaboration of the bureaucratic imperial state. Significant population expansion occurred under the very late Ming and the Qing dynasty. Again, this was a pattern of developments of considerable importance. It is vital then to recognize that during much of the early modern period, largely if not entirely independent of Western influence in any cultural or political sense, Asian kingdoms, Asian empires were establishing significant achievements that would have marks, that would leave marks that outlasted the empires themselves. It is also true, however, that some of the gunpowder empires began to show signs of wear as early as the late 17th, early 18th centuries, though here the pattern is varied and we need to be careful of oversimple generalizations. The Safavid Empire began to weaken in the early 18th century. The Mughal Empire began to weaken even somewhat earlier. Later 17th Mughal emperors made what, in retrospect, it seems were two clear mistakes if the goal was to preserve Indian vitality and Mughal rule itself. In the first place, several later emperors began to reverse the policy of religious tolerance, began clearly to favor Muslims in administration, began in some instances to attack Hindu religious shrines, and began to create an atmosphere of religious mistrust that would continue to affect Indian history, be exacerbated by aspects of British rule in ways that obviously have contemporary implications as well. The second mistake, if this kind of historical judgment is permitted, the second mistake was quite simply an effort at overexpansion. The attempt to press Mughal boundary southward led to significant military expenditure, the amassing of vast armies, including elephant forces, sometimes successful, but at real expense to the taxation base and indeed the basic economic vitality of India as a whole. By the 18th century, Mughal hold over India was beginning to fade in favor of local princes, the revival of that tradition of localism so frequent in Indian politics. Indian economic prosperity was declining. Indian cultural and educational apparatus was in some